I call upon my people, the Palestinian people, to move on, to understand that the war is over, and to develop a constructive vision of building a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, rather than a destructive vision of no Jewish state.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Einat Wilf. Professor Wilf is a former member of Israel's parliament, the Knesset, and today we will discuss the ideas of her latest book, The War of Return, and that book is co-authored with A.D. Swartz, about the politicization of the Palestinian refugee issues and how it is a central obstacle to peace. And I must say before I started recording this episode that I looked into a paper that I wrote when I was 17 years old. And it started out by saying, hello, this is the Daily News. We are reporting today from the conflict between Israelis and Palestinian soldiers. And there are 300 people dead and 450 people wounded. So this conflict has been going on for generations. So I'm sure you are now sitting in Tel Aviv or in Israel, and I'll just have to welcome you to the podcast first of all, Einat. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Lovely to be a guest on the podcast.
So as you could see, these issues about the Middle East, they have been with us for many generations now, and at least for my generation, I'm not even living in Israel, but you are. So tell me just a small story about what you have done. I tried to say something about it, but you could just give the listeners a very brief review.
Okay, so a bit of background. I'm Israeli, born and raised. I entered politics in the early 2000s. I worked with Yossi Beilin, the architect of the Oslo Accords. I worked with Shimon Peres, who was a key figure in that. I later became a member of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, as a member of the Labor Party. I was part of a coalition and party with Ehud Barak, who's known to be the Israeli prime minister who went further than anyone in trying to make peace with the Palestinians. And ever since being out of parliament, I've been speaking and writing on issues relating to Israel, the region, and the path to peace.
Yeah. And then we'll have to just discuss. Well, the path to peace is, of course, the theme of your book, The War of Return. And first of all, what does the War of Return mean?
So the book of The War of Return, written with my co-writer, Adi Schwartz, emerged from a very basic question that people like myself, like Adi, people who came from the Israeli peace camp, who were thrilled in the 1990s with the possibility of peace, with the Oslo Accords, with Barak's negotiations in Camp David, people who really believed that the conflict is over land, that the day that the Palestinians would have a state in the West Bank and Gaza is the day we would have peace. We are an entire generation and people of the peace camp who watched the Palestinians, Arafat in 2000, Abu Mazen in 2008, and later walk away from clear, concrete opportunities to have a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, to end the occupation, to not have settlements, to have a capital in East Jerusalem. All the things that we were told that the Palestinians wanted and all the things that we thought the Palestinians should have. And we saw them walk away from the opportunity to have those things. So we ended up asking a very simple question. What do the Palestinians want? Because not only did they walk away from having those things, it was always followed by this bitter, terrible violence against civilians, massacres in our streets, buses being exploded. So we wanted to know all this violence, all this hatred, when the Palestinians could have had again and again and again a state in the West Bank and Gaza with no settlements, with a capital in East Jerusalem, we asked a simple question, then what do they want? And what Adi and I realized, he used to work for a Haaretz, a very liberal left-wing paper in Israel. We asked, what did the Palestinians want? And we realized that almost to our embarrassment, the answer was staring us in the face. To the credit of the Palestinians, they told us what they wanted for nearly a century now. They wanted no Jewish state in any part of the land from the Jordan River, from the river to the Mediterranean Sea, from the river to the sea. So from their perspective, from the river to the sea, there is no legitimacy for any state for the Jewish people in any borders, with the West Bank, without the West Bank, at any place, it's not legitimate. And I'm saying embarrassingly, because again, to the credit of the Palestinians, they've said it very clearly for a century. They've said it very violently for a century. And we just didn't listen, or when we listened, we didn't take them seriously. We projected what we thought the conflict was about rather than actually listen to what they told us that the conflict is about.
So that was also one of my questions. The river to the sea, of course, for you, that's obvious from what you're saying. The river to the sea means, of course, the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, and that means the whole of Israel today, including those parts that are Palestinians, so parts of that country or that countryside. So that what you are saying is actually that this is the wish, and this is what they tried to tell you, and you haven't been aware of that until now.
Yes, I mean, and as I said, we were, I'll tell you two almost anecdotes. When the book came out in English, it was reviewed by a Palestinian. And of course, he was angry about the parts in the book where we explained that there's no such thing as the so-called right of return, that no refugees throughout the 20th century had it, the Palestinians are not special. So of course, he was angry about that part. But in terms of the main thesis of the book, that the Palestinians demand things, the effect of which is no Jewish state, such as the non-existent right of return. The analysis he gave was basically, seriously, it took two Israeli researchers years of work to just realize what we've been telling you all the time. Like, it wasn't clear that this is what we were saying. And a few months ago, the book got an award in Israel. And it was in security studies, and in the audience sat two Druze officers. And if you know, the Druze are a small community, they're Muslims, they're Arabic speaker, but they're set apart, and they're loyal to the states where they live, so they serve in the Israeli military. So there were two Druze officers in the audience, and at the end of our speech, they come up to us and they say, "Congratulations, we found the two people in Israel who finally understand what the conflict is about. The Arabs keep telling you, and you just don't want to get it into your head." So I think there was a lot of projection. In the book, I invented a word, I call it Westplaining. We use a kind of Western attitude to explain. Palestinians will go and say, "We don't want two states. We want it all from the river to the sea. Zionism is evil. The Jews are not a people." I mean, they speak very clearly. And what you're going to see people do, including us in Israel and the Israeli left and the peace camp, will say, "No, the Palestinians are just saying this kind of maximalist, extreme things. But what they really want is something more limited. They want a state. They want an end to the occupation. They want no settlements." What they want is more limited than what they say they want. So this was our assumption for a very long time. And we believed that when the Palestinians will have an opportunity to have something, not everything, but something, they will say yes.
But they didn't.
No. Like, when you told them, you know, you can have something, they were like, "That's not good enough. We want everything, and we're going to keep fighting for everything." And we're going to win, because at the end of the day, we are the majority. So another century, another five generations, it doesn't it doesn't matter because the Jews are just going to disappear one day.
Yeah, because that's exactly your point. You say that the, and then we'll have to go into the not practicalities, but of course the historical origins of the Palestinian refugees, because this is a refugee question also, and how you define being a refugee, and how you consider them, and how you explain in your book together with your colleague how you see Palestinian refugees compared to other refugees around the world, and why this war of return, or exactly why the book is called The War of Return, because this is about refugees and how you see refugees. Can you explain that?
Certainly. What I just said is very difficult for people to accept, that the Palestinians have been consistent for a century in their vision that there should be no Jewish state in any borders whatsoever. And one of the ways that, and that is really what the book, The War of Return, is devoted to, is to show that one of the major ways that the Palestinians are devoted to this idea of no Jewish state in any borders is by creating this idea of a right of return. Now, it doesn't exist, but what the Palestinians believe it means is that the Arabs who became refugees as a result of the war of 1948, and it's important to say, already in 1947, the Arabs of the land, later to be called Palestinians, had the opportunity to have an independent Arab state in half of the territory of the land. No one was displaced by this point. Sometimes Palestinians like to present Israel and Zionism as something that of necessity displaced Palestinians, like that the state of the Jews had to come necessarily instead of Palestinians. No, there was room for two states, and that was the proposal, and no one was displaced. The Jews mostly settled the malaria-ridden lands. So all the Arabs had to do was say yes, and they would have had their state. But as they say very clearly already in 1947, 1948, they don't want a state in part of the land if the other part of the land would be a Jewish state. So they go to war. They go to war with the declared purpose of no Jewish state. They lose the war. The Jewish state emerges from the war standing. They fail in their purpose to prevent Israel from being born. As a result of the war, there are Jewish and Arab refugees in the territory. And just to be clear, the Arab refugees, that's basically 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, you know, people are going across the ceasefire lines. There are Jewish and Arab refugees. The Jewish refugees they move on. They build their lives inside the state of Israel. The Arab refugees refuse to move on. They understand that if they become Jordanians, Lebanese, Syrians, begin to build a new life, this means that the war is over. And they don't want the war to be over because, as far as they're concerned, maybe they lost in 1948, but the goal of no Jewish state is still the goal. So they'll keep fighting. So unlike all the other refugees throughout the 20th century, in the 20th century, there's tens of millions of refugees. Why? Because the entire 20th century is about empires disappearing and states coming into being where the empires go. These are always very bloody occasions. When empires disappear and new states are created everywhere in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, there's war. And there's refugees, the Indian subcontinent, East Asia, Africa. There's lots of refugees. And of course, Europe in 2 world wars. The message to all the refugees is move on. These are new borders. Wherever you are on the side of the border, that's it. Just move on. Because there's an understanding that if people will want to get things to go back, it's just going to be a recipe for endless war. But the Arab refugees, increasingly called the Palestinians, say, but this is actually what we want. We want the war to continue. We don't want to accept that the war of 1948 is over because we don't want to accept that Israel exists and that it's acceptable or legitimate. So as a result of a variety of circumstances, such as oil and the Cold War and the Arab world, the Arab refugees are able to create a loophole, which no other refugees in the world got, where they alone, from all the refugees, Ukrainians and Poles and Bulgarians and Muslims and Hindus and Germans and whoever, they retain this organizational ability generation after generation. When the numbers continue to increase, today it's 5.7, 5.8 million, they begin to say, we are still refugees from the war of 1948, and we possess something that no refugee had. We possess the right, nothing less, to go back, but it means really to settle inside the state of Israel. This is the mechanism by which the state of Israel is erased, because the numbers are such that if all the descendants of the Arab refugees exercise this settlement, the Jews will become a minority in an Arab state. So whenever Palestinians over the years have said, oh, we support two states, a lot of people were, including in the Oslo Accords, were like, that's great, we can have peace. And me too, you know, Israelis of the left, great, we can have peace. Palestinians support two states. But we never listened to what they also said. They said the right of return is holy. Well, if you say, if you're a Palestinian who says you support two states and the right of return is holy, then the only two states you've ever supported is an Arab state in the West Bank and Gaza and another Arab state that will replace Israel. Exactly. There has never been a Palestinian vision of peace, of a Jewish state next to an Arab state.
Exactly, that's what it means. And as you say here, it's also, you have some stories actually about how weird this might sound, because you mentioned passports and you mentioned what's in them and where people actually live, and you say we are talking 47 48, so obviously people might have been, well, those people being young people then, or even older people, they're dead now, but their relatives and next generations and even further generations, they are still calling themselves refugees. So when we think about refugees, we think about people being displaced and living in camps and so forth. Can you just mention a few examples of where people live and how it's organized in reality?
Certainly. And this is one of the most amazing things, because in politically, emotionally, the refugee issue is the biggest issue for Palestinians. But in practice, it's a non-issue. So as I said, about 5.7 million are registered as refugees by the special agency called UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which after more than 70 years is still a temporary agency because it was supposed to finish its work after 2-3 years. So for example, 40%, about 2.3, live in the West Bank and Gaza. So these are places that, for example, in Norway, I'm sure people think of as Palestine. They call them Palestinian territories, occupied Palestinian territories. So you have 2.3 million Palestinians living in Palestine, most of them under their own governments, whether Abu Mazen or Hamas, living under their own governments in Palestine, born in Palestine. They were never displaced by any war. Many of them are middle class. We think of camps as these tents and terrible weather. No, even the camps are neighborhoods, but most of them don't live even in those refugee neighborhoods. They live, you know, you could be a middle class lawyer living in Ramallah. You're 30 years old. You've never been displaced by war. You were born in Palestine. You were born in Ramallah. But you will still carry a card and be registered as a refugee from Palestine. But you're in Palestine. How can you be a refugee from Palestine? And the reason, of course, to us, it might appear ridiculous. To him, it's very clear, because the Palestine from which he's a refugee is not Ramallah, is not the West Bank. It's not the Palestinian Authority. It's this mythical from the river to the sea Palestine, which will one day replace Israel. So it's a very important political identity, but he's middle class. He's never been displaced by war. So he's not a refugee in any sense that we think of it, but it becomes this political identity. Another 40%, so by now we have an 80% majority, live in Jordan. Jordan, to its credit, naturalized the refugees. It gave them citizenship. They're Jordanian citizens. They're in the government. They're in the parliament. They vote. They can be elected. Nowhere in the world is a refugee someone who's a citizen of a country. Once you got citizenship of a country, you're done. And these are, and again, most of them have never escaped war. They're the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. Many of them are wealthy business people. They do not live in camps. 82% of the people who are registered as refugees in Jordan don't live in refugee neighborhoods. They live in Amman. Again, there are business people who do business with the Gulf, but they'll have this identity as a refugee. Jordan and Lebanon, they register 1 million so-called refugees. We know from recent data, most of them have left. So they might have citizenship in Norway. They might have citizenship in Germany, in the US, but they will still be registered as refugees. My favorite refugee in the whole world is the father of supermodel Gigi and Bella Hadid. He's this multimillionaire American playboy living in LA, he's an American citizen, but he's still registered by UNRWA in Syria, because that's where he was born as a baby, as a refugee. So he's not a refugee in any way that we think about it, but it's a political identity. So this is where the huge gap is. As a political issue, it's the biggest issue. There's no more important issue for the Palestinians than the notion that they are perpetual refugees and will one day go back. This is like the essence of who they are. But in practice, it's not a problem because they either live in the West Bank and Gaza, which means they don't need to go anywhere. They're citizens of Jordan. They don't need to go anywhere. They have citizens of other countries. They don't need to go anywhere. You probably have around 200,000, 300,000 people living in Syria and Lebanon without any kind of citizenship. They need to be taken care of, but those are small numbers that refugee agencies know how to handle.
Mm. So, yeah, let's go over to, I have a question here. It's just say, what has gone wrong with UNWRA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, which is what it means.
Yeah.
And when, of course, I phrased the question like this, and obviously what you're just saying is that something's gone wrong here because they count and they issue statements of being a refugee. So what has gone wrong? Why do we still have this temporary organization? And what have the Western states? Because that is the subtitle of your book.
Yeah.
It's the Western kind of picture. Yeah. What this is.
Yes, actually, the book is not just about the whole Palestinian history of the refugees and UNRWA and how it became this major defining element of the Palestinian identity. It's a lot about how the West let it happen and how the West really indulged this. Because in the rest of the world, the West was very clear. No one's going back. We bring an example of another temporary agency that was established at the same time as UNRWA called UNCRA. And the K is for Korea. And basically, you had 2 million Korean refugees from the north. This is three times the number of the Arab refugees at the time. UNCRA settles all of them with a quarter of the budget of UNRWA at the time and basically closes after 5 years. Now, think about South Korea today. That could have been the Palestinians. That could have been countries in the Arab world. This is what UNRWA was supposed to do. UNRWA was supposed to be a temporary agency for a few years that puts a lot of money into settling 700,000 people in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, helps them get good jobs, paying jobs, and moves on. And that's it. And ends the story. What happened is that the West wanted to close UNRWA after several years because the Arab refugees themselves refused to cooperate because they knew that if they would cooperate with UNRWA's effort to give them new lives and to move on, it would mean that they accept that the war is over. And as I said, the most top priority was to say the war is not over. We'll keep fighting. And basically, the Arab states were able to use the power of oil and the concern of the West over the Cold War to force the West to keep UNRWA open forever. And basically, from the 1950s to the present, UNRWA is still a temporary agency, constantly renewed, basically keeping alive this idea that Palestinians, like I said, that the 30-year-old lawyer from Ramallah is a refugee, and never, never, never doing anything to actually bring the number of refugees down. So if you think of the actual UN refugee agency, the UN High Commissioner for Refugee, like all the other refugees in the world have one agency that actually tries to make their lives better and to end the story. So the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, it goes into refugee situations. Initially, it takes temporary care of them, hoping that the war is over and things will settle down. But if it's not, it doesn't sit for 70 years and say it's not okay. It basically tries individually to make sure that each one of the refugees has a better life elsewhere. This is the one thing that UNRWA refuses to do. It will not, and this is why the father of Bella and Gigi Hadid can still be a refugee, because UNRWA never says, oh, this guy's doing fine, we can cross him off our books. They never do that. They don't cross anyone off their books. They only add people. So first generation, so second
the,
generation.
I mean, the problem is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger because people are having babies and kids and they are growing up and so forth. So that is just...
So the numbers just keep expanding from the initial 700,000 pretty much to 5.7 million today. The numbers only keep growing because UNRWA refuses to do the one thing that a refugee agency is supposed to do, which is actually settle the refugees, tell them, have a good life, and cross them off the books. Mm.
So do you think that the Western states have been naive when they have expected that the Palestinians would give up their right to return as part of a peace process? And how central do you think this was in the assumption when the Oslo process came about? That's, I mean, many years ago from now. And do you think that these issues have, you have actually said that they have, but you can maybe explain a little bit more also apart from the United Nations refugee program here, how central this is to the failure of any peace process that have been, well, that the Western countries have been trying to set up. So it's, we are still there. We are in 2022 now. And I mean, there's no peace ahead, is it?
Yeah. So I'll start from the end. In the book, we have a very simple sentence that says, for there to be peace, the war must end. You know, a lot of Europeans believe that they're experts on peace and they come to Israel and they'll be like, why can't you be like us? Look, we live in peace after so many years of being at war. I was like, yes, but you are very clear that the war was over. You know, Nazi Germany was clearly defeated, signed an unconditional surrender, and then you could start building the new Europe. But it was clear that the war was over. So that's our first message. To have peace, the war must end, which sounds as banal as could be, but this is the one thing we missed, that at least from the perspective of the Palestinians, the war was never over, and they did not want it to be over. So you can't start a peace negotiations when one side is still actively engaged in the war. And the West has been blind several times. You know, sometimes willfully blind, sometimes naively blind. So in the 50s, they were blind, not to UNRWA. In the 50s, and we show it in the book, they knew that the organization was useless. They knew that the Arab refugees refused to cooperate with the settlement. But they were naive in thinking that continuing to fund UNRWA and this refugee situation would not be a big deal. And we show in the book how actually the funding of UNRWA and the sustaining of this perpetual refugee and myth of return really was the foundational for Palestinian terrorism, for Palestinian maximalism, because a generation after generation was raised with the belief that they have a duty to take back, so to speak, the country from the invading Jews. So if you raise another generation after another generation to keep fighting to take back their land, then you're going to have war forever. So once the West was blind to how terrible funding UNRWA was going to be, then in the 90s, we were all blind. We were so desperate for peace. We were so desperate to believe that it's possible that we were blind to how important the idea of from the river to the sea, Palestinian refugees was to the Palestinians. Mm. The people on the Israeli side, the people on the Western side, thought it was a practical issue, like the one I described. So yeah, there's 200, 300,000 people in Lebanon and Syria that will need to be settled. And they thought of it as a practical issue. Maybe sometimes they thought of it as a matter of giving money, but they thought that at the end of the day, it's a practical issue with practical problems. And they thought that the Palestinians approached it as a practical problem with practical solutions. Now realizing that it was a matter of identity, as a matter of who they were. And we thought that when they presented with the opportunity with the state, they would give up this idea of the war of return, which of the idea of the right of return, which we thought didn't make sense. They knew it didn't make sense. We thought, we were sure that they understood that it made no sense. What we realized that at the critical moment, rather than give up this right of return, which doesn't even exist, to get a state, an actual thing, a state, independence, they preferred to give up a state in order to keep fighting for a return, for no Jewish state. Hmm. They've made their priorities very clear. And the book, The War of Return, is really about no longer being blind. It's basically saying, look, we were blind again and again and again to how big an issue it is, to what an obstacle to peace. And because I'm still a peace person, I'm still a left-wing peace person who believes in two states, who believes that the Palestinians deserve the liberty and independence of their own political unit. But I know that we will never get there as long as their top priority is for the Jews not to have a state. Hmm. So I'm saying, look, for all the people who really want peace, stop telling yourself stories about what this conflict is about. Let's recognize that this is a conflict. Sometimes I call it very simply a conflict between Jewish Zionism and Arab anti-Zionism. It's a conflict between the Jews wanting a state and the Arabs wanting the Jews not to have a state. That's the conflict. It's actually very simple. So the conflict can end in one of two ways. Either the Jews no longer have a state, and that's what a lot of people seem to want, or, as I prefer, the Arabs will no longer be anti-Zionists. The Arabs will no longer put as their top priority no Jewish state. And one of the ways to start getting there is to end the entire mythology of the perpetual Palestinian refugeehood. Sometimes I say that in Western foreign policy, sadly, too many people want to feel good, but not enough people want to do good. Feeling good is like you give money to UNRWA and you feel that you're, you know, a friend of the Palestinians, and that makes you feel good. But it doesn't do good because it just fuels a century of war. What's required to do good, but it doesn't feel good, is to tell the Palestinians the war of 1948 is over. Insofar as your goal in the war was to prevent the establishment of a Jewish state, you lost. The Jewish state is here to stay. As long as your goal is from the river to the sea, no Jewish state, as long as you believe in this right of return, then we're not your friends. We will be your friends once more when you come to us saying that you want an Arab state next to Israel rather than instead of it, and that you understand that it means no return and that it's over. Now, as I'm sure you know, this does not feel good to say those things. I say those things to audiences. I said those things when I was just now in Oslo, to people in the Foreign Office, to people in Parliament. I'm aware that people cringe when I say that. Who wants to go to the Palestinians and tell them you lost the war of 1948? Move on. Like, no one wants to say that. Everyone wants to pat them on the head and say, no, you're poor, you're miserable, keep fighting. It's justice, it's rights, it feels good. But the people who want to feel good, I'm happy, I mean, good for them that they feel good, but it means that I pay the price in another generation of conflict. And that's not, you know, I don't think it's fair.
I understand what you're saying. And then you also, of course, describe how you see the situation for a two-state solution today, because you've just explained how it could be done. And I mean, for it to be done, it must be, as you also explained, some give and take. So, I mean, it's and here you've exactly explained how this idea of having a state that does not include Israel anymore is not a possibility. So that is that, but then you have to give up something else. Your wish of having the whole country, which you can't have, or the whole piece of land. So, but we are talking now, it's not even a month after the elections or the last election in Israel, in which Netanyahu won again, but with support from the far right.
Yeah.
So let's go into some of the politics here, because, I mean, it's clear to see, actually, when you see a two-state solution, if you're looking at the piece of paper and looking at a map, you actually have two states. You have, it is Israel and it is Palestine on to divided into, but actually it is there. The borders are there. But there are other things that might make these things really, really difficult. And I suspect that with Netanyahu again, and with the support from the far right, and as far as I've been reading about the far right, I would personally think that the chances now to discuss peace, they are deteriorating. But what are your views on this?
So I'll take it from several angles. On the Israeli-Arab front, the prospects are actually interesting, because when it comes to the Abraham Accords, when it comes with peace with the Arab world, this is a top priority for Netanyahu. Netanyahu genuinely believes, this is one of his most fundamental worldviews, is that the path to peace with the Arab world, broadly speaking, emerges from Israeli perseverance, from Israel. Basically, the more the Arab world realizes that Israel is not going anywhere, the more it's likely to make peace with it. Sometimes I, not so jokingly, call the conflict a mutual battle of exhaustion, right? They're trying to exhaust us to give up, and just basically to say, you know, all these wars and terrorism and international condemnations and economic boycotts, we're out of here, we're done. So they're trying to exhaust us, and we're trying to exhaust them into saying, you know what, they're not going anywhere, so let's just stop it. So we're trying to exhaust them to give up on their anti-Zionism and trying to throw us out. And it's a mutual battle of exhaustion. And Netanyahu very much believes that the more Israel can get the Arab world to understand that it's just useless to try to get rid of Israel, the more likely we are to get to peace. So I think it will be interesting to follow this government, and especially Netanyahu, in trying to make peace with the Arab world. And he declared it as a priority for him. Then there's the question of the Palestinians. And here, I would say, and this might be a bold statement, no Israeli government matters, right wing or left wing. Because, and this is the one fact that will never change, the Jews are a tiny, tiny, tiny national, ethnic, religious, linguistic minority in an overwhelming Arab and Islamic world. Right? The ratio between us and them is 1-60, 1-100, depending who you include. Which means that the state of Israel, home to the Jewish minority in the Middle East, will always compromise with the Arab and Muslim majority for real peace. We will not compromise for something that will bring about our demise, but if we think it's a real serious peace, we will compromise. And we did it again and again. And Netanyahu did it, and right-wing governments did it. So it actually doesn't matter if the government is left-wing or right-wing, and I will even say it doesn't matter if it's an extreme right-wing government. Because at the end of the day, the fact of the Jewish minority status in an Arab region will always make the state of Israel willing to compromise. So for me, that's not an issue for any government. The only question we need to ask, are the Palestinians finally giving up their more than century-long war against the Jews having a state? The day that the Palestinians declare that the war is over is the day there's going to have peace. And that I'm completely certain.
So let's just say that you started out here by referring to a review that you got from a Palestinian. And I've just read a book recently that I also know that you have read, A Paragon. It's a very strange name for a book, but it's about two men. And one is Palestinian, the other is Israeli. And both of them lost their daughters. One, of course, killed by an Israeli soldier, the other by a Palestinian suicide bomber. So they are actually very, very opposite from the start. This doesn't really happen at the same year, but these two men become friends across the borders. And the book is just saying from all angles and in every variation that you could think of, what is happening in those crucial moments when those two young girls are dying. And it's excruciating in a way reading this, because you come very close to both of them, both the Palestinian, you understand him and you understand his life, and he's even been a prisoner for in his youth, and the other one with his background. The feeling that you get when reading these things is actually that there might be Palestinians that would like peace in the way that you suggest, even though your reviewer said you needed to Israeli researchers telling him or telling everyone that the problem was this right of return that you've just explained. But this book is, again, I think, just another example of something, but it's a special story, and it's probably because it became famous. Could you just tell me a bit about what you think about this, and maybe generalize a little bit of how this can might be used in order to contribute to understanding and contribute to the way that you see forward for going for a peaceful solution?
So the book, in one way, contributes to understanding, and in another way, actually makes understanding impossible. The part that it contributes to understanding is really just giving the very sense of, like, the suffering, the people. In that sense, it's really a beautifully written book that kind of gives a lot of poetry and around kind of what it is for both sides to live in the midst of this conflict. The part where the book actually makes it impossible to understand how to get to peace and what's going on is that you have a very classic bringing together of Israelis and Palestinians. And you see it in almost every panel when people say, oh, it's a balanced panel. We have an Israeli and a Palestinian. So this is like a balanced book, an Israeli and a Palestinian who both want peace. But if you listen to what specifically they're saying, the Palestinian says the occupation must end, and the Israeli says the occupation must end. Okay, so you have an Israeli and Palestinian who are both saying the same thing and who are both saying the wrong thing, because the problem has never been the Israeli military control of the West Bank and Gaza after the war of 1967. Once you see the history of the conflict, you actually see how little 1967 makes. It makes no difference. Because before and after 1967, with or without the occupation, with or without the settlements, the Palestinians reject a Jewish state in any border. No amount of military control of the West Bank and Gaza, 0 or 100 or 50%, no amount of settlements ever made any difference. We think of it as a process that made a difference, but it actually didn't. The Palestinian position, as I said from the beginning, has been very consistent for a century, and nothing changed. Even the refugee situation didn't change anything, because the Palestinians in 1947 also rejected a Jewish state, and there was not a single refugee. They rejected a Jewish state in 37 and 27. So, yes, every time they they use violence and lose, then you begin to have more issues. You have refugees, you have occupation, but they don't make any difference to the fundamental cause and reason why the conflict continues. So what is missing in this book is not the symmetry or the false symmetry of an Israeli and Palestinian who both say that the occupation should end, which again is important, but the occupation could end tomorrow. Israel could withdraw its entire military from the West Bank, as it did from Gaza, and it could withdraw all the settlements, and this would make zero, but zero difference to the conflict, because the problem is not the military presence of Israel in the West Bank. The problem is Israel, the fact that Israel exists. So what we need for there to be a truly balanced book is to find an Israeli who says, and there's many Israelis like that, prime ministers, political parties, who say we need to divide the land, the Palestinians should have their state, and then we need to find a Palestinian, and that's going to be close to impossible, who says the Jews deserve their state too. We need to divide the land with a Jewish state. We understand that this means that we're not refugees and there's no such thing as a right of return. And I call upon my people, the Palestinian people, to move on, to understand that the war is over, and to develop a constructive vision of building a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, rather than a destructive vision of no Jewish state. That would be a truly balanced book. The problem, of course, is that there's no such Palestinian voices.
But do you think, yeah, because that's my next question. Do you think that it might just, since we're into literature, that it might be if such a person would read your book, let's say, and would start thinking and start maybe writing another novel or whatever, and or even a paper that could be distributed. Do you think it's impossible, or do you think it could happen? And then I'm talking about a Palestinian doing this.
Let me put it this way. When I say what I say, a lot of people tell me, you're making terrible generalizations. This cannot be all the Palestinians. Look, there are extremists on the Israeli side. There are Israelis who think there should be no Palestinian state or want from the river to the sea. So why are you claiming that the Palestinians are all devoted to this idea of no Jewish state? And my answer is always very simple. If you think I'm wrong, I've given you the easiest task in the world to disprove me. Find me a Palestinian, you know, someone who writes an op-ed, a small NGO, who publicly and clearly says the war of 1948 is over, we are not refugees, there is no return, and we need to move on, and we need to have a vision of a small Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, not from the river to the sea, next to the Jewish state of Israel. And we need, so I always tell them, look, if you think I'm making terrible generalizations, please prove me wrong. It's so easy. I've made it. I've given you the easiest task in the world. In almost every other topic I speak about, I say highly likely, probable, but here I'm very bold. So I'm saying, come disprove me. I give them homework. They never come back. You know, I once spoke to a very, very important leader in the U.S. Congress who read The War of Return, and he, you know, he really wants peace. And he says, but there must be young Palestinian leaders who are saying what you said, what you're saying needs to be said for there to be peace. And I tell him, no, there aren't. And he had a young assistant who works with him who was like, oh, thank you so much for validating me. He's like, my congressman keeps on sending me on these missions to find young Palestinian leaders who will say that they understand that the Jewish state is legitimate and that they need to live next to it. And I never find them. So sometimes people tell me, oh, they exist. And I always tell them, you know, don't tell me that you know them. Don't tell me that they told you, you know, whispering in your ear. I need someone who writes an op-ed. I need someone who starts an NGO. I need someone who says it publicly, because I no longer trust Westerners to tell me what Palestinians think, because I've seen how wrong Westerners, you know, they interpret it through their wishful thinking. So I'm putting it here also on your podcast. Someone who speaks about it publicly in no uncertain terms. That's what we need. And I also said it in Norway to the members of the Foreign Office. I was like, all the money that you give now to the Palestinians, find that Palestinian who's finally saying what needs to be said. Give him or her all the money. Don't give it to UNRWA. Don't give it to all the organizations that continue this mythology of from the river to the sea, because this is just putting fuel on the fire of the conflict. Give the money to people who will actually say all the not nice things that are required to be said to make the conflict over. And the same goes for literature. I would love to see the book that finally puts, that is really symmetrical. Jews who say the land should be divided equally between Arabs and Jews and both are legitimate, and an Arab-Palestinian who says the land should be divided because the Jews have an equal right to self-determination in the land. That's what we need to hear.
So, yeah. And then finally, just a short answer here, because I have been starting this podcast by telling you that I have been into this conflict ever since not since I was born, but since I could write about it. So it's a long time ago. And you as well, living in Tel Aviv. And my question to you is, do you really think that we will have peace or coexistence in your part of the world? And then I'm thinking not about the Arab countries, but between Palestinians and Israelis in your lifetime.
So I call myself a long-term optimist. I don't know how long it will take, but I know what it will look like. I must say that the peace agreements and the normalization and the Abraham Accords in the Arab world are giving me even greater cause for optimism. The Palestinians need to go through a painful process of realizing that an entire century that they devoted to having no Jewish state has been wasted, and that they can stop wasting their time by having a smarter focus on having a Palestinian state next to the Jewish state. I think the sooner we can help them understand that this is what's necessary, rather than indulging them in the belief that Israel is temporary, that Zionism is evil, and that it would one day disappear, this would truly benefit the cause of peace.
And finally, your book, it might make a difference because you have explained something. And hopefully, since it's translated into English, it's possible to read it for Western countries or for people, as you just have mentioned many times here, have been trying to support something that is not contributing to peace, because that's what you're actually explaining. So do you think your book could make a difference? And do you think that what you just explained what Westerners should do? It's very, very hard to support someone that doesn't exist, as you just said, a Palestinian saying that we are giving up on this idea of having the whole land. But as being practical, you've been to Oslo and you are going around with your colleague to talk about this. Do you ever see people in your home country and in Palestine looking and reading your book?
Certainly. And the book has been translated not just into English, but to Norwegian and Spanish and German. And I've devoted a lot of time, not just to researching and writing it, but to speaking about it and speaking with people. It's not an easy thing to accept. People would very much love to believe the easier things, that only if there was no settlements or no occupation, or if it weren't Netanyahu, there would be peace. It's much harder. What I'm proposing is harder. What I'm saying is that the entire Palestinian identity has to change away from anti-Zionism towards pro-Palestinian state. It's a difficult process. As I said, it requires people not to feel good, but to actually do good. These are hard things. But I must say, if I do have a source of optimism these days, some of it is from some friends we have in the West who do get it, but increasingly from the Arab world. because the Arab world, the Abraham Accords country, the voices calling for normalization, they know what the conflict is about. You can't fool them. They know that it's never been about settlements or the occupation. They know that it's always been about the Arab rejection of a Jewish state and any borders.
So maybe then the thing would be to go through the Arab countries and having them talk to the Palestinians.
And that's what they're doing. And they are saying things that no Westerner dares to say. They're speaking in very clear terms. They're telling the Palestinians, we're done. We're not writing a blank check to you saying no. This is not interesting to us. This like anti-Zionism. We don't want to spend our time on that anymore. I have Arab colleagues who are saying things like the Abraham Accords, they're not against the Palestinians, even though this is how the Palestinians experience it as this great betrayal. It's not for them. It's not against them. It's just about us moving on away from wasting our time in this anti-Zionism. And one day they will understand that they need to move on too. So they're saying things very clearly. And this is where I find more hope these days, from the Arab countries and leaders telling the Palestinians what they needed to hear 70 years ago, I would say 100 years ago. Divide your land with the Jews. They're legitimate claimants to the land. You can have some of it. They can have some of it. None of you will have all of it. Move on and you can have a really good life.
Let's just end with that, Aina, because I think it's good to have some optimism here. After so many years, we could count even more, as you say, 100 years, or of course, 100 years and even more. But thanks so much for joining me, Aina, and lovely to talk to you from Tel Aviv. And if you like Liberal Haltimi, you can rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, civita.no. And of course, the book that Aina has written together with her colleague, The War of Return, is available, as you just said, in Norwegian and in English. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Haltimi. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.